Okay, thank you very much for having me here. I'll be talking about work that appeared recently in the archive. I wrote this paper on my own, but I'm indebted to these three gentlemen for lots of insight. Everything wrong is my fault, but I've learned many things from them. So this paper is about discussing subregions in gravity with an eye to computing the entanglement entropy of the graviton. So first of all, why should you care about studying subregions? Well, in many situations, it's useful to think about a physical system in terms of its constituents. And we normally think of fields as having different degrees of freedom on different points in space. So it's natural to group these degrees of freedom at different points into subregions and then think about our field system in terms of its constituents being its constituents subregions of space. Now, this picture is nice and it seems to make sense, at least classically, but when you try to make sense of it in quantum mechanics, you run into some trouble. So one part of this trouble comes from the fact that fields in quantum field theory are just operator value distributions and you're supposed to smear them against test functions. So that makes it impossible actually to infinitely sharply localize a quantum field degree of freedom. And if you are talking about a subregion and you're thinking about all points within this subregion, the points that are very close to the edge of your subregion really don't live just there because you're supposed to smear them against test functions that will have some tails going outside the subregion. But anyway, we can forget about this now or regulate this problem actually, as we will see, and proceed with this division of the system into subregions. And once we have a system separated into subsystems, and we're doing quantum mechanics, we can ask about the entanglement of each of these parts with the rest of the system. So let me just, in one slide, remind you what quantum entanglement is. It's this property of quantum mechanics that tells you that there's more information in the whole of the system than in the parts of the system. So this is an example of an entangled state. The amount of entanglement that there's in a state between any two parties can be quantified with several measures. The one I will be caring about today is entanglement entropy, which is nothing else than the von Neumann entropy of this state reduced to one of these subsystems. So for this state, this looks something like that. Now, famously in quantum field theory, this quantity has divergences. And these divergences come from the fact that you can't localize degrees of freedom arbitrarily sharply near the entangling surface. And well, this is a problem I discussed in the previous slide. However, this divergence is very interesting, especially to somebody with a gravity background like me, because if you regulate this divergence, what you discover is that this leading divergence goes with the area of the subregion in units of the cutoff, and then there's some expansion in powers of this cutoff. And this area is very suggestive of black hole entropy. So indeed, another system in which entropies go with areas is just gravity. So there's an old hope in quantum gravity that perhaps black hole entropy can be understood in terms of entanglement entropy across the horizon. So this is a very ambitious kind of dream in which we would understand fully entanglement entropy, fully gravitational entropy in terms of entanglement entropy. So that would involve some non-perturbative understanding of gravity in terms of quantum field theory. The kind of setup I'm going to have in mind today is less ambitious. I'm going to imagine that we already understand some semi-classical geometry, but we can allow for quantum fluctuations on top of this geometry. And then entanglement entropy becomes interesting because it tells you about the quantum corrections to gravitational entropy, to geometric entropy. So as you know, the entropy of black holes is the area in units of in Planck units. And then the entanglement of the fields outside is supposed to tell you about the quantum correction to this purely geometric entropy. Okay, so in black hole physics, this quantity is interesting for these two reasons. And in ADS-CFT, there is a generalized understanding of the notion of gravitational entropy. And entanglement is playing a crucial role lately. We are understanding that entanglement is one of the main ingredients for the emergence of classical space from the CFT. So there's many reasons to study entanglement coming from a gravitational background. So just to continue elaborating a little bit more on these two applications of entanglement to gravitational problems. So in black hole entropy, actually considering, in black hole contexts, considering the entanglement entropy of the fields outside lets you save the second law of black hole thermodynamics when black holes evaporate. So if you're a bit naive and you recall that black holes decrease because of Hawking evaporation, you might think that this is a conflict with the second law of thermodynamics because black hole entropy is given by the area and the area is shrinking in this process. But you can save yourself from this paradox if you consider also the entropy of the fields outside and you add it to the gravitational entropy. And then because the fields outside are going from a pure to a mixed state, the entropy of these fields is growing in time, and that is compensating for the fact that the area term is shrinking. And in ABS-CFT, we also like to add the entropy of the fields outside to a gravitational entropy in the context of the Ryuta-Kayanagi proposal. So let me remind you that in ABS-CFT is a duality between quantum field theory and quantum gravity. And we can think about this quantum field theory living on the boundary of space. And any legal question about the quantum field theory has a legal answer in terms of a gravitational calculation. You may ask in the quantum field theory for entanglement in a certain quantum state between degrees of freedom inside and outside of a subregion. And this has been argued to be given by the area of a minimal surface in the bulk, which looks something like that, to leading order in Newton's constant. And this formula is expected to receive quantum corrections. Actually, it has been argued to receive quantum corrections. And the leading quantum corrections are given by entanglement of the graviton across this Ryuta-Kayanagi surface. This formula has played a main role in many recent breakthroughs in ABS-CFT. In particular, from this formula, you can get the insight that the type of states that give rise to semi-classical gravity duals form a quantum error correcting code. And you can also use this formula to argue, to prove some theorems about bulk reconstruction from CFT degrees of freedom. So it's very important to understand this formula well. And this general formula well, in which we add gravitational entropy to the entropy of the fields across the region we're considering. And one of the puzzles with this formula is that one of the fields that you should always consider is the graviton, and the entanglement entropy of the graviton is poorly understood. So I'd like to talk a bit about how to define a subregion in perturbative quantum gravity and how to start thinking about this term here for the graviton. Yes?
Naive slash too advanced question. So when you start now thinking about this entropy as the entanglement entropy, and now combine that with your previous words about the black hole evaporating, does that mean that the region that you're considering is shrinking or not?
The region should be changing because the black hole is becoming smaller, so you're considering, yeah, I guess you're considering a region outside the black hole that is growing as the black hole becomes smaller. Yeah, I think so. Okay, so I'm gonna be discussing how to talk about subregions in gravity with an eye to this, but before I do that, I'll talk about subregions in gauge theory. And gauge theory and gravity share some subtleties when it comes to defining subregions. And the main problem is that in gauge theory, you should always think about gauge invariant degrees of freedom or gauge invariant observables. And in gauge theory, there's some degrees of freedom that are extended in space. So it's easy to argue for this because we normally think of the degrees of freedom in, for example, electromagnetism as given by the vector potential and the electric field. And we have to make observables from these two constituents, but of course the vector potential is not invariant under gauge transformations. To make gauge invariant observables, we need to integrate the vector potential across loops and consider Wilson loops. And clearly these things are not localized in space. They have some finite extension. So the main problem when you want to discuss the division of the degrees of freedom of a gauge theory like electromagnetism across a subregion is that you have to decide what you do with degrees of freedom like this one, like this Wilson loop that goes across this region, which don't belong naturally to the inside or the outside of this subregion. So there's been much work about this lately, and there's several points of view of how to deal with this problem. I'm gonna basically take the point of view that Cassini, Huerta, and Rosabal argued for in a paper 3 or 4 years ago.
You say gauge theory, but here you just really mean U1. That's the working example.
Yes. I'm going to be working with the gauge theory. I'm going to be writing down is U1, and then I'll move on to gravity. I'm going to summarize very quickly now this way to deal with this problem of non-factorizing degrees of freedom in electromagnetism, as was suggested by Cassini, Huerta, and Rosabal. And what they argued for is to think in terms of algebras of observables and try to define your region really in terms of which observables you're going to associate to this region, which gauge invariant observables you're going to associate to this region. And then a long discussion actually can be summarized by saying that defining a subregion in a gauge theory has to do with choosing some boundary conditions for the gauge fields on the edge of this subregion. And one way to think about this, so there's several ways in which you can choose these boundary conditions, and two natural ones are going to be called the electric and the magnetic choice. And one way to think about these two choices is that you're thinking about your system in either position or momentum space. And in electromagnetism, the position space kind of variables would be the Wilson loops. The momentum space type of variables would be the electric fields, and we're thinking about the state of our system either in this type of algebra or in this type of algebra. And then these are two ways to think about the degrees of freedom inside of the subregion end up translating into fixing the electric field on the boundary or fixing the magnetic degrees of freedom on the boundary. So once you have taken these boundary conditions, what happens is that you write your state as a super selection, as a sum of super selection sectors. So you decompose your state into different states that are themselves coherent, but each of them are added in an incoherent way, depending on the values that the electric fields take in the boundary. So this is, you write your state just as a mixture of states, each of which have a definite value of their boundary conditions. So in this case, I've chosen one particular set of boundary conditions, which is the one that fixes the electric field in the boundary. So once you've written your state in this way, it's very easy to calculate the entropy, and the answer is just here. It has two terms. One of them is an average of the quantum entropy in each of these sectors with definite value of the electric field, weighted by the probability of being in each of these sectors. And then there is another term, which is just the Shannon entropy that we associate to this probability distribution of the electric fields on the edge of this subregion. So a couple of comments. These boundary conditions are not fixing the electric field to be anything prescribed on the boundary. What we're doing is to just think about our algebra of observables in a way that drops the canonical conjugate to the electric field and the boundary. So there's nothing in the algebra that will change the value of the electric field and the boundary. So we write the state in this way, at definite values of the electric field, but the electric field is not doing anything we prescribe in the boundary. The electric field can change. It's just that we cannot make it change with any of the operators that we kept in our algebra. So
there's another option, which is to extend your algebra.
That's right, yes.
You keep that canonical operator.
That's right. So there's another.
You respect gauge invariance.
Exactly. So there's another way to deal with this problem that Will and Laurent wrote extensively about. And what this does is to extend the Hilbert space of your system such that you can keep both operators and you can keep gauge invariants in the boundary. However, I'll be taking, for reasons I will explain soon, I'm going to be advocating for this procedure. So as I said, this is just one of several possibilities that you have to choose an algebra that you associate to this region. And this the state differs depending on which algebra you choose, but this difference is a UV difference. It's something that's very localized on the edge of your subregion. And when you consider UV finite quantities as mutual information or relative entropy, these differences just go away. This is a UV problem. Okay.
Sorry, is this even true in topological theories?
I haven't thought about it.
Because I think Cassini, Huerta, Rosapal were freaked out by the fact that it didn't seem to be. You couldn't change the topological entanglement entropy.
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. I don't know.
When QQFT usually you extend,
In an abelian gauge theory, this is the same as extending, but in general, if you had a non-abelian.
This choice of center is the same thing as extending.
Yeah, the electric center is equivalent to extending. In a non-abelian theory, it's not equivalent. And that the other thing is the thing that works for TQFTs. So I would expect you had something that's like a non-abelian gauge theory. This would not be the same as what you would get from studying the TQFT.
When you say it's a UV thing, does that just mean leading divergence or like
no,
log divergences?
So I'm gonna So I was just mentioning now measures of entanglement, mutual information, and relative entropy. So if you consider just entanglement entropy, these UV differences actually affect terms that are otherwise considered to be universal. So if you're insisting on computing entanglement entropy, the choice of algebra that you associate, so the choice that you make when you associate an algebra to a region affects the answer that you get when you're computing entanglement entropy. And this is an example of these differences that you might get. So if you do the calculation in the electric picture I just discussed, Will Donnelly and Aaron Wall did that, and you get that the entanglement entropy, that's it, that's for the photon across a sphere in the vacuum, gives you this kind of expansion. So you get the area divergence I discussed in the beginning, and then you get the logarithmic divergence with this particular coefficient. But then if you do the calculation with a different prescription, in particular using mutual information as your regulator, you get something different, which is that you get a different leading divergence. Same area law type of divergence, but with a different coefficient. But of course, that's not physical. And then the logarithmic divergence comes with a different coefficient in this case. So that's a bit worrisome because logarithmic divergences are usually expected to be universal properties of entanglement entropy. It's telling you something about conformal anomaly, or it's expected to be insensitive of how you regulate the calculation, because if you just scale your cutoff by a number, here epsilon, the logarithmic divergence is the same. But we see here that it depends on these subtle UV features in the boundary of the subregion. Okay, so I mentioned this with some detail because towards the end of the talk, I'm going to talk about some other logarithmic corrections to entropy. So just to recap what I said about gauge theories, the main problem when trying to define subregions is that gauge theories describe extended degrees of freedom. So you need to decide what to do with these extended degrees of freedom when you want to think about the subregion. From the algebraic point of view, there's several definitions available. But then if you calculate things like entanglement entropy, including the universal contributions to the entanglement entropy, those seem to depend on which definition you took. OK?
Yeah, just out of curiosity, or maybe I'm supposed to know, but for the universal, you focused on the scaling with the cutoff. If I focused on the scaling with the size of the system, are these UV problems still there?
I think they are because, it's here, not the scaling with the system.
Well, there's a dot, dot, dot. I don't know what's in dot, dot, dot.
That's, so it's subleading in powers of the cutoff. Dot, dot, dot.
So if there was a log R over some mass scale in the, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. If there was a mass scale, this problem would be very different. I'm just thinking about the free photon. But I think this is a worrisome problem.
In 2+1 dimensions, you do have exactly that kind of thing. You do have a log e squared r, because e is a dimensional, the Young-Mills coupling is a dimensional quantity. And that is actually a UV finite term, which is independent of these choices. In 2 plus 1, that's true. So if you had like a mass, that actually does seem to not really care about these choices. Maxwell theory in 2 plus 1.
Maxwell, pure
yeah.
Maxwell.
Compact Maxwell with a coupling e squared,
okay.
Which is massive,
okay.
Which is dimensional.
Okay. So now I'd like to move to gravity. So I'd like to, let's start with some preliminaries. So in gravity, these problems are going to be much worse because in gravity, there's no local observables. The reason why there's no local observables is because local observables should live in one point, and one point is not something that's diff invariant. It depends on which choice of coordinates you had. If you change your coordinates, you have to change the characterization of this point. So this problem is much worse than for spin one case. In spin one, at least we had these local observables. The electric field was sketch invariant. In gravity, there's nothing like that. Also, in gravity, generic surfaces are not gauge invariant, because the way you would describe a generic surface in a spacetime is by giving an embedding map, and that makes explicit reference to coordinates. If you change your coordinates, you're going to have to change your embedding map. So generic surfaces don't have a gauge invariant characterization. So it's not clear that in gravity, the notion of a gravitational subregion makes sense in general, because that's not diff invariant. So we're going to see aspects of this in the remainder of the talk. And what I'll first do is to redo the analysis for the photon using some phase-space techniques, and then apply these phase-space techniques to the graviton. So the main object I'm going to be looking at is the symplectic form, which is an object defined in phase space. It's the most important object in phase space. And this is, let me remind you, it's a two-form in phase space. It's an object that if you give it two vectors in phase space will return you a number, and it will do it in an antisymmetric way. So these two vectors in phase space, they would be infinitesimal changes of the state of your system. This object informs us about the structure of phase space, which is the space of the degrees of freedom of our system, or more covariantly, it's the space of solutions to the equations of motion. I'm sure you are all familiar with this, but you haven't seen this before. This object for a one-dimensional particle is just the familiar DQ wedge DP that lets you measure areas in phase space. Now, the point of this talk is to discuss gauge symmetries, subregions, and phase space. So let me first remind you how you deal with gauge symmetries in phase space. So the usual way that you deal with a system with gauge symmetries in phase space is to embed this system in a larger, redundant space, and then that is gauge redundant, and then reduce it to the physical space. So continuing on the example that I showed previously with electromagnetism, we normally think about the degrees of freedom of electromagnetism as being parametrized by the vector potential and the electric field, and the phase space would be the set of all possible vector potentials and all possible electric fields, and of course this is redundant information. Now, how do we see that? Well, the real space of configurations for the electromagnetic field lives really on a constrained surface in this big phase space. And this constrained surface is the Gauss law constrained surface. It's the surface in which the electric fields we're considering satisfy Gauss law. And one thing you see once you restrict yourself to this surface is that the symplectic form that you started with in this bigger phase space has a null direction. And that null direction corresponds to nothing else than gauge transformations of the vector potential. So you see that once you are in this constrained surface, you have something that's not a degree of freedom anymore because it annihilates the symplectic form. Now, if you want to talk about the physical phase space, that's the phase space up to gauge transformations, what you want to do is to dispense with this direction that is not a degree of freedom, but rather a gauge transformation. And you can do that in the same way as you dispense with directions in geometry by doing a Kaluza-Klein reduction of the symplectic form to the base that's to the base of the fiber bundle that's generated by these directions. So let me elaborate a bit more. So if these directions are also symmetries of the symplectic form, you can just dispense with them altogether and go to some reduced symplectic form that doesn't have these directions at all and that's non-degenerate. So just a cartoon of this picture. So we started with some redundant phase space gamma. On this phase space, we want to concentrate on some physical surface, which is a constrained surface C, which here I'm depicting as a cylinder. Once we constrain ourselves or we restrict ourselves to this cylinder, we see that there's some null directions to the symplectic form, G. So G would be the directions that move us around this cylinder. And we can just Kaluza Klein reduce these directions down to the base of the cylinder, which is the segment, which is the space of physical configurations up to gauge transformations. So in other words, in this picture, this constrained surface looks like a fiber bundle over the physical space gamma bar. So I'm insisting on this condition that this null direction of the symplectic form should also be a symmetry direction of the symplectic form, even though that's normally trivial. So if we have done this operation of reducing to a constrained surface properly, it's no extra requirement on this symplectic form that this is a symmetry direction. And we can see that just by calculating the lead derivative in phase space of this guy using Cartan's formula. This is just expressed in terms of the exterior derivative and contractions with this null direction. Now, I didn't say that, but if you remember, the symplectic form is a closed form. So this just drops from this calculation, and we're left with this. But then if we restrict it properly to this constrained surface, this is zero identically, and the exterior derivative is zero identically. So normally, this is not an extra requirement on the restriction to a constrained surface, but it might be that while we're doing a calculation, we find that this is not automatically satisfied. So if we find that, what we are learning actually is that we didn't restrict our symplectic form properly on this constrained surface, because if we had done things properly, this would be an identity trivially. So the offending term possibly would be something like that, would be the fact that we are not able to see that the contraction of the gauge direction with a symplectic form is writable, at least locally, as an exact form. So if we find that this is not true locally, what we learn is that we have not restricted our symplectic form properly.
So I thought that when we contract I with W, we just find zero.
Yes, but it has to be zero, and it also has to be the exterior derivative of something.
So are you thinking away from the constraint surface now or something, or?
I'm going to be thinking on the constraint surface.
What you mean is that, you know, usually if you contract that with the gauge parameter, it's delta of the constraint. So if the constraints are satisfied, this is zero on the constraint surface. Does that answer?
I'm a bit confused because, I mean, zero.
The issue is that you contract that guy, the transformation, and you get delta of the constraints.
Ah, okay.
Right. That's why the constraint is the generator, the Hamiltonian generator.
So then when you evaluate on the constraint, you automatically find zero.
Yeah.
Okay, I see.
Okay. So,
do you have any case where you have non-trivial first cohomology of this delta differential, in which case you would say that this is that the lead derivative is zero, but then generators not Hamiltonian.
It's always going to be locally Hamiltonian, but I haven't thought about topological subtleties. Yeah.
This is not much.
So the reason I'm going in some detail with this is that later in the gravitational case, we will see that this is non-trivial, at least the way I'm doing the calculation. So now I want to discuss what to do with the gauge symmetries in the presence of subregions. And the summary of what I've explained in the last couple of slides is that a gauge degree of freedom is a non-degree of freedom. And you diagnose this because it's a null direction and a symmetry direction of the symplectic form. Now, I want to imagine the separation of the system into subsystems. And the key guiding principle that I'm going to have for the remainder of this talk is that this separation into subregions does not introduce new degrees of freedom into the system. And that's a key property of imaginary surfaces. Imaginary surfaces don't have degrees of freedom. So entangling surfaces are also imaginary surfaces. So I'm going to insist very much that that's still the case, that there's no degrees of freedom when we introduce the separation. And we will see that that leads to some choices that are similar to the algebraic choices in the case of electromagnetism and something new in the case of gravity.
Sorry, so the edge modes of the standard electric center in a gauge theory, you would not call them degrees of freedom because of this?
So I would call them degrees of freedom, and that's precisely what I'm trying to avoid in this construction. So when you extend your Hilbert space across a subregion in order to maintain gauge invariance, you have to introduce these new degrees of freedom, the edge modes. What I'm going to be doing in what remains is to try to follow the spirit of Cassini, Huerta, and Rosabal, in which you just work with the algebra you were given at the beginning. So you don't introduce any extra stuff. And
sorry, but this is just a choice of methodology, right? The answer, at least in the U1 case, was the same, right? As Will mentioned.
In the U1 case, in the electric center, it gives the same story. But in the U1 case, in the algebraic approach, you have these other choices of center that result in different notions of what you mean by a subregion.
Yeah.
OK, so let's see what happens. So this is my guiding principle. So from now on, I'm going to demand that the introduction of these subregions keeps this gauge direction null directions and symmetry directions of the symplectic form. And let's see what we get from that. So we can do this for the photon. This is the symplectic form of the photon. It's just the contraction of the gauge potential, of the variation of the gauge potential with the variation of the electric field. And it's antisymmetric with respect to these two variations. Now, I want to imagine that I'm considering just a subregion. So I'm going to consider a boundary to this Cauchy slice. And I'm going to consider this symplectic form evaluated on a gauge transformation, which is just the change in the gauge potential given by the gradient of a function. And then you plug this in, you integrate by parts, and you use Gauss' law, and you find this boundary term here. So remember that the guiding principle is that gauge transformations are still null directions of the symplectic form. So we want to make this vanish in order to satisfy that. And there's two choices we have. One is to just not allow these gauge transformations, not consider them anymore. And the other one is to just not let the electric field, the normal component of the electric field in the boundary, fluctuate. Now, if you remember, these are very similar to the, well, these are actually the same choices I had before in the algebraic setup. So we want this to vanish. And remember that in the algebraic setup, we had two choices. Either we freeze the gauge potential on the boundary, or we freeze the electric field on the boundary. So if we freeze the electric the gauge potential in the boundary, these gauge transformations are not allowed anymore because they would change the gauge potential. And the other option is to just freeze this to zero, which is the one I described in more detail earlier on, which just vanishes this term here. So these are the constraints that we get from demanding that these are null directions of the symplectic form. And let me emphasize that there is no extra constraint from demanding that these are Hamiltonian directions to the symplectic form. It's easy to see that this expression can be written as the variation of something, and that something is this Hamiltonian, which is the generator of gauge transformations on the boundary. Okay. So hopefully I have convinced you that these conditions of nullness of the symplectic form on a gauge transformation are equivalent to the setup by Cassini, Huerta, and Rosabal. And now I'd like to do the same thing for the graviton. So we're going to do exactly the same thing. I'm going to take the symplectic form of the graviton, and I'm going to evaluate it on a diffeomorphism. Okay, the diffeomorphism just changes, is a variation of the metric just given by the Lie derivative with respect to some vector field. And that vector field is the generator of the diffeomorphism. So just as before, we also have another metric variation because the symplectic form has two arguments. And using standard phase space techniques like those of Ayer and Walt for diff invariant theories, we can rewrite this term as a surface integral. And this surface integral involves two familiar objects. One is just the variation of the Noether charge associated with this diffeomorphism. And the other one is related to the term that we get when we consider the variational problem in general relativity and we have to integrate by parts. And let me emphasize that this has to be a boundary term because in the absence of boundaries, diffeomorphisms are trivially null directions of the symplectic form. The subtlety only comes in the boundary. So what I want to do in what follows is to evaluate this right-hand side here. This was actually first done by Jeffries, Lefkowitz, Maldacena, and Chu. And I'm just going to follow their steps and write the expressions. So I want to write this in terms of the geometric properties of this boundary surface. And one way to do that is to just choose coordinates adapted to this boundary surface that make this calculation easy. So this is going to be my choice of coordinates. So this is the entangling surface in red. Coordinates spanning the surface are these yi coordinates, and there's d minus 2 of them. We are in d dimensions, and d minus 2 directions span the surface, and 2 directions span the orthogonal directions to the entangling surface. We can move in space and in time transverse to the entangling surface. So we construct these orthogonal coordinates just by shooting geodesics away from this entangling surface. And if you do this in this way, and you write the metric around the entangling surface in these coordinates, you find that to leading order in the distance, the metric in these directions is just flat because you use these geodesics to construct this metric, these coordinates. And then in the directions parallel to the entangling surface, you have to leading order just the induced metric on the entangling surface. And then the subleading order, you find the extensive curvature.
Usually, the only thing you can fix is that it's conformally flat. So there's still a conformal factor in the normal directions. How do you get rid of that?
No, if you choose normal coordinates, the metric just looks like this.
Yeah, but this conformal factor does not. You always have to check that this. I mean, you always have to check that this guy is not a null direction for the symplectic structure you're starting with. So you cannot really gauge that away in some sense. I mean, you could choose this coordinate, but it amounts to reducing the number of degrees of freedom in the boundary. You see, this is always the thing, is that now you have symplectic structure. You cannot just decide to throw away. You have to check that whatever you're throwing away is in the kernel.
Yeah.
What I'm saying is that that guy is not really in the kernel. Okay. I mean, you could decide to work there, but it's not the full symplectic potential.
Yeah, so I'm gauge fixing the second variation in the metric, and I am throwing away things that can be eliminated by changes of coordinates in the second variation.
But if you call gauge fixing, it's no longer gauge fixing. That is because these guys are no longer gauge symmetries. They are boundary symmetries of your original structure. So that's always the subtle. When you have these boundaries, what was previously gauge is no longer gauge. Some stay gauge and some are not. So anyway, the conformal factor is in general.
Yeah. So I have a
complicated things.
Yeah. I'm aware that this plays a role in your analysis with Will and.
But you can change the conformal factor by doing a dibio that looks like a dilatation in the normal plane.
Yeah, but that is a symmetry.
Isn't that zero on the, like the another charge for that is zero?
No, it's not zero. That's the point.
It depends only on the.
What I'm writing down now.
It's okay to restrict that as long as you're aware that you're.
Okay. So everything I'm doing now is in terms of just geometric data on the surface, and I have discarded all the gauge variant data, like this one. So it's going to be convenient to write these objects here in terms of their irreducible parts. So I'm going to split the induced metric into its area, density, and its conformal structure, which has determinant 1. And I'm also going to split the extensive curvature into a trace part and a traceless part. Traceless part with a bar satisfies this condition. And again, remember there's d minus two dimensions spanning the surface, two dimensions spanning the orthogonal plane. And that's the reason, actually, why we have an extra index in the extensive curvature. If you're not used to saying that, it's just because we can move into orthogonal directions to this entangling surface. So now you plug this into the expression I wrote earlier in terms of another charge and the theta term, and you see what you get. And there's three types of diffeomorphisms that give a non-zero contribution a priori. These are boundary diffeomorphisms that are changes of coordinates within the surface. There's boosts that leave the surface untouched and boost the normal plane in the surface. And there's translations that would deform the surface. Now remember that we want that these three things drop from the symplectic form, and that amounts to requiring that they are symmetry directions of the symplectic form and they are null directions of the symplectic form. So for this and this, they are trivially Hamiltonian. You just look at what you get and it's trivially the exterior derivative, the phase space derivative of something. And they become null depending on which boundary conditions we take. In particular, we can make the boundary diffeomorphisms null by fixing the conformal class of the induced metric. This is a tensor, and this would, in general, change with respect to a diffeomorphism on the surface. So by fixing this, we get rid of this diffeomorphism in the same way we were getting rid of the gauge transformations earlier in the magnetic center by fixing the gauge potential. The boosts are generated by changes of area. This is the familiar statement that the area is the Noether charge of boosts. And we could fix them to zero by fixing the area. However, I'm going to remain agnostic whether this is something that you actually want to do. And the reason I want to remain agnostic about this is because these boosts are actually not acting on the surface. They don't touch the surface at all. And the surface is a fixed point of them. Yes?
To get the boost in the kernel, do you need to fix the total area or the area
element? The area density, yeah. So I'm going to assume, I'm going to remain agnostic to this. Yeah. Actually, I tend to think that this is not something you want to do, fixing the area of this surface. Now, the ones that are more subtle are these translations. And what you get is written down here.
What are you doing there? Are you taking the whole surface and translating, or you're translating a bit of it? I'm just not sure.
This one here?
Yeah.
Yeah, so this can be a field on the surface, so that could be translating just a little bit. Yeah. Likewise for the boosts, etc.
Something about this looks unfamiliar, because I thought the surface diffeos somehow coupled to this other term that I know, this piece of the metric that I don't see anymore, but you used to have it. It was like a little.
Yes, empty. So there's that's right. So,
so what happened to that?
Yeah, I just didn't write it down. There's another choice that you can take to make this null, which is fixing this torsion of the normal bundle. This would be the analog of going to the electric center in the electric problem. Here, what I'm advocating for is going to the magnetic center, in which instead of fixing this, which is the generator of this transformation, I'm fixing this, which is the thing that changes under these transformations.
Does it show up in the symplectic?
It doesn't show up in the symplectic form for the same reason the gauge potential didn't show up in the symplectic form evaluated on a diffeo in the electromagnetic case.
So doing this is more like fixing the gauge parameter, you're saying?
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
And in general, here you're presenting that there's really two choices, but in general, I mean, if I can rephrase, let's say from the extended phase space point of view, what you have is that you have a boundary symplectic structure, and then any type of boundary condition you want to take is a choice of Lagrangian submanifold of your boundary structure. So now it's like, you know, you could choose Neumann or Dirichlet, but there's also any you know, Robin, like P, Q, or P plus Q. So there's all this. So
yes.
It's really, you know, in general, there's a manifold of choice of Lagrangians.
That's right.
Like, which is,
yeah, yeah. So there's.
You choose the purely, I don't know, electric one, but that's just one among many choices that you decide.
That's right, yes. Yeah, yeah. So there's many choices that you can take here.
As Lagrangian.
Yeah. And I'm just showing you one of the choices that does the job. Now, this is what remains for the symplectic form for these surface translations. It has, I've split it here in two lines. And the objects that appear here should all be more or less familiar. This is the trace of the eccentric curvature that appeared before. This is the generator of these transformations, the vector field generating these transformations. Here we have the conformal class of the induced metric and the traceless extrinsic curvature. Now there's these epsilon guys around. This one with two indices is just the binormal to this surface, and this epsilon h is just the area density on the surface. Now I want to demand that these transformations are null and are Hamiltonians of this symplectic form. And you have to play both with the top and the bottom line to ensure that this happens. So both actually have to vanish independently. The bottom line, you can see, is an obstruction to this being written as a Hamiltonian, because it's not the derivative of something. There's variations that appear multiplied by things that are allowed to vary, for example, the area density here and the traceless extrinsic curvature here. So I'm going to demand that both the top, which is the Hamiltonian part of the transformation, and the bottom vanish independently. And again, there's a choice of things you can do here. And the one I'm going to show you is this one, which is to fix the trace of the extrinsic curvature to be zero and its variation to stay zero, and also to fix the variations in the conformal class of the induced metric to have zero contraction with the traceless part of the extrinsic curvature. So in this choice of variables, you get that you have superselection sectors available to you when you have set the extrinsic curvature to have zero trace and to stay with zero trace under all the variations you're considering. And these superselection sectors are now labeled by the conformal class of the induced metric, which is the thing I was fixing earlier, subject to this constraint. Now, you might be worried that I'm now claiming that this definition of a gravitational subregion in general relativity only makes sense for extremal surfaces. But in most of the cases, I said in the beginning of this talk that it's interesting to discuss and to compute the entanglement entropy of the graviton. Actually, this is the surface you care about. For example, if you're considering stationary black holes, you want to calculate the entanglement entropy of the graviton across the bifurcation surface, which is an extremal surface. Or if you are in ADS-EFT, you want to compute it across Brüttger-Carnaghi surfaces, which are extremal surfaces. Yes?
Since you're also now restricting the allowed variations in phase space, like on the first line you have a condition on the allowed variations. Is this like a restriction on the allowed also on phase space, or is it only a restriction on the surface?
I think it's only a restriction on the surface, but I don't understand this as well as I would like to. But so I'm going to give you now an interpretation. So as I just said, I have advocated for writing the superselection sectors to a gravitational subregion as being labeled by the conformal class of the induced metric subject to this constraint. And this is only, there's another thing I'm not writing here, which is that the trace of the extrinsic curvature is zero and it has to stay zero under all variations. Now let's interpret this. Well, having surfaces defined by the fact that they are extremal surfaces is a diff invariant way to define them. So that's a good way to deal with one of the problems I raised earlier on. We have to talk about diff invariant surfaces because we're doing gravity. And then the interpretation of this term is that it discards variation in the conformal class of the induced metric that would be achievable by a small displacement. So if we change if we keep our space-time fixed and we move the surface a little bit, the conformal class of the induced metric is going to change by this amount, and that's precisely what this discards. So my claim at this point would be that this is here to make sure that we're only considering one surface per geometry and not multiple surfaces per geometry when we're doing this sum. And the kind of translations that this discards should be translations that take you to a nearby extremal surface, and I'm going to argue that generically this exists, which has to do with arguing for solutions to the Jacobi equation. Yes?
I thought when you were getting rid of the surface stipios, you already fixed delta H to be zero.
Yeah, but now I'm going to, so that's within each superselection sector. But then you have, delta H is really not fixed to be anything. It can vary. But within each superselection sector, delta H is zero. Now, what I'm saying is that when you sum over superselection sectors, which is varying all these delta H's, you have to sum subject to this constraint. So.
But in each sector, it's delta H is zero.
Yes.
There's no sum.
In each sector, this condition is trivial just because delta H is not varying. This condition is non-trivial when you consider all the sectors
on which delta H
varies.
Now, if you vary your second bullet point, when you vary it by a diffeo using delta H proportion to K, in that case, the restriction is really that you're demanding, you know, what you would call the news to vanish, like the extrinsic curvature tensor to vanish. Is that what you're demanding? Meaning there's no gravity wave, you know, going through that surface.
I don't know.
If delta H is proportional, so when you write delta H proportional to K.
This is just the variation. What I'm saying is that if you translate your surface a little bit,
yeah,
the conformal class of the induced metric changes by this amount.
Yeah, but you want that variation to vanish.
I want this to vanish, and this
means that K squared is equal to zero.
No, I'm not gonna actually assume that K squared is zero. I'm gonna assume that zeta here is zero. So I'm gonna assume that this condition works to forbid this displacement to get rid of this guy.
So you're not going to displace the surface?
Yes, I'm going to displace the surface. So let me.
K is generically invertible, or it's not.
Sorry?
K is an invertible matrix.
Doesn't have to be.
Upstairs is just.
It's just raising the indices with a. K could be zero. This condition, by the way, this condition trivializes in many cases of interest. For example, in bifurcation surfaces of black hole horizons,
yeah,
there's no such condition like that.
Yeah, because there's no graviton, that's what I'm saying. So if there's no graviton, I mean, yeah, the Kij, the Tesla's component, measure the graviton.
Yeah.
So, yeah, if there's no graviton on that surface, that's fine. These are very, very, very special surfaces.
Yeah.
In a random space-time.
Yes.
You have gravitons everywhere.
Exactly. So I'm claiming that this condition works to discard variations that would otherwise. So if you just change the metric a little bit and there is extrinsic curvature, mm-hmm, this change is happening. When you contract this with the traceless part of the extrinsic metric, it's non-zero. Mm-hmm. And I want this to be zero. So what this does is to discard these translations so that we're only considering one entangling surface for space-time.
And this one is characterized by what condition then?
By the condition that this is its induced, this is its extrinsic curvature. So if you displace the surface, its extrinsic curvature is going to change in general.
So you can take any surface.
Yeah.
And then you just don't displace it.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. I think that's the interpretation.
That's, okay. That's usually what we do with entangling surfaces.
Yeah, yeah.
We look at the motion that do not displace them.
Yeah. So yeah, I'm just. I'm just trying to interpret this condition as this. So a cartoon for what this sum means, now going back to phase space, is that we're separating our surface into these superselection sectors. These superselection sectors are here in red. In each of these superselection sectors, the conformal class of the induced metric stays fixed, and the extrinsic curvature stays zero. And then we can move from one to the next superselection center by varying the conformal class of the induced metric, provided that is not the same thing as that is not proportional to the.
So when you go to the superselection sector, is something where the conformal class of H is fixed,
mm-hmm,
but K is arbitrary.
Yeah. Now, so I have claimed that generically these entangling surfaces might be deformable. I'm not claiming there's any finite deformations of these entangling surfaces. This is all at the infinitesimal level. So I'm just saying that there is a flat direction. And to support this claim, I'm going to consider the Jacobi equation. Jacobi equation is the equation that tells you about displacements of extremal surfaces. And it's an equation on the displacement, which is this kind of vector-like quantity by which you're deforming your surface. And it looks something like that. It looks like the Laplacian on the surface applied to this vector times a potential. And this potential depends on the curvature of the background and the curvature of the surface. There is a term in this potential that basically goes like the square of the extensive curvature minus the square of the extensive curvature. So if you have a region where this dominates, then this potential has a negative value there. Now, if you approximate this potential by this negative value, this equation has solutions which are localized around any point you want. And these solutions are just Bessel functions, which you can localize wherever you want.
So this Jacobi equation, if I understand, you start from an extremal surface.
Yes.
With arbitrary k.
Yeah.
And you deform it. And you look at the deformations which are still extremal.
That's right. That's what this Jacobi equation tells you about.
And you want to see that there is no such solution? Or that
no, I want to see that. I want to see that sometimes there are these solutions, mm-hmm. and that boundary condition before gets rid of these displacements. So this is an argument that there might be solutions generally, and the previous boundary condition is supposed to get rid of these deformations, right. So that we're considering. Sorry.
Right, previous in k squared and non-zero. Or?
No, this boundary condition. This boundary condition is ruling out these deformations, which are solutions to the Jacobi equation. So there are nearby. This is all infinitesimal, by the way. I'm not claiming there's any finite deformations in general of this. And that boundary condition is to rule out this so that we're considering only one entangling surface per spacetime. So let me now recapitulate what I said about the graviton. So the principle we had is that subregions are imaginary separations, that they don't introduce degrees of freedom to the system. This translates into a certain condition in the symplectic form, which is that you should be able to still symplectically reduce. So diffeomorphisms of this subregion should still annihilate and be symmetries of the symplectic form. This was non-trivial for the graviton, both of these conditions. We found that a good boundary condition is that boundary conditions of these subregions are extremal surfaces. And then in a certain choice of center, you get that the superselections of the graviton in these subregions are labeled by the conformal class of the induced metric, possibly the area as well, but I'm inclined not to include it here, subject to this condition. And this condition works to discard deformations to nearby extremal surface. So just for the future, I'd like to use this to gain some quantitative understanding of this formula to try to do some calculations of the entanglement entropy of the graviton across a Ryutaka Nagi surface and say something about this. And then I'd like to explore more this possible deformability of Ryutaka Nagi surfaces and whether it means anything for bulk reconstruction. And going back to the black hole problem, I'd like to explore with these kind of techniques a mismatch that has been reported in the literature between Euclidean quantum gravity calculations of the one loop black hole entropy and loop quantum gravity calculations of the one loop black hole entropy. So Sen has reported this calculation for the Schwarzschild black hole using Euclidean techniques. These Euclidean techniques are very much used and tested in string theory, where you can compute black hole entropy to subleading powers in Newton's constant, and you can match this with string theoretic predictions. But this predictive power just breaks down when you have a non-extremal black hole, like the Schwarzschild black hole. Nevertheless, you can still carry out the Euclidean calculation, and this is what you get, which has a very different logarithmic coefficient compared to other predictions. So I'd like to understand whether there's any wiggle room in this calculation in terms of this Hilbert space picture, whether going back to these logarithmic divergences of entanglement entropy for the photon, there's any way to play with this number, or what physics fixes this number, and more generally, to try to get a real-time understanding of these quantum corrections to black hole entropy in terms of entanglement across the horizon. So just to summarize, I emphasize that discussing regions is subtle when you have systems with gauge symmetry. This discussion is important if, for example, in this problem of understanding the quantum corrections to black hole entropy, I argued that the phase space of our gravitational subregion is gauge invariant if the boundary is an extremal surface. And then there's this point that I don't understand to my full satisfaction, that perhaps extremal surfaces are locally deformable, and we need to care about it. Okay, thank you very much.
You went to extremal surfaces, but if I remember correctly, you just had delta k, delta of the trace evictions of curvature zero, right?
No, I had both. They were both.
Oh, I see. They were both separate conditions.
So delta k being zero is an abstraction to this deformation being Hamiltonian. But then k has to be zero also because of this term here. We want also this to be an null direction of the symplectic form. And this variation, you can split it into two terms. One of them is the variation of the extensive curvature. The other one is the variation of the area density multiplied by the extensive curvature. So if the extensive curvature is zero and stays zero, this term is zero identically, and this can be a null direction to the symplectic form.
You also hold the area density fixed?
No, I didn't.
But could you?
I could, yeah. If I fixed the area density, then I wouldn't have to start with an extremal surface from this point of view. Yeah.
So the later you restrict your parametric psi b, right? So the part of the logic is, but here you're looking for a general psi b such that that guy vanish. But later you argue that you want to even restrict the deformation parameter. So then it weakens the condition there, right? So.
Yeah, I don't know how to think about these psi b's that would not take you to nearby general surfaces. I think you're saying that.
Well, I mean here, you impose a set of conditions by demanding that all possible deformations are admissible.
Yeah.
But then here you argue that they cannot be admissible because they have to be in the kernel of K. Bar.
So what I said is that, so this condition discards all possible translations. Then I said that some of these translations take you to nearby minimal surfaces. So of course this you want to get rid of, because this would be allowed by, this would be allowed.
K bar, you called it V. So anything in the, any psi in the kernel of VAB, what you call later VAB, right?
Yeah.
It has to be zero.
That's any psi in the kernel of this equation has to be zero, yes. So we.
That equation, not the previous. Okay. Because the previous, go back to the previous equation. The previous equation, you want k, you want. Okay. If I put together the equation behind the bullet and the one.
Yeah.
Then I get a condition that VAB psi b has to be equal to zero.
Yeah. So that means that perhaps there is a non trivial psi that would take me to a nearby surface, and then I want to discard this. I want to set it to zero. So if there is a candidate psi that would move me to an extremal surface, I just want to discard it by setting it to zero. Now, what I argued later on is that these candidate psis that would take us to nearby extremal surfaces are there. They are the solutions of this Jacobi equation. And this condition just makes sure that we don't explore these solutions to the Jacobi equation, because we only want to consider one entangling surface per geometry.
But for these zetas that solve this Jacobi equation, they would probably be non-vanishing at the boundary at infinity.
Well, not necessarily. So for sure there are such zetas that don't vanish in the boundary at infinity, and those you don't want to discard. Because that corresponds to doing changing physically what you're doing. You're just computing entangling entropy across a different surface that's nearby. This kind of psi that I wrote down here is the one that you do want to discard. It's one that is localized in space. And this one in particular is localized in space because it's just a Bessel function. Bessel function decays at infinity. So this one wouldn't displace the boundary surface. Tomorrow, yeah.
Oh, great. So, yeah. Let's thank the speaker again.